Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Well, today it hit a full-page ad in Human Events, the National Conservative Weekly, and we are thankful to the publishers of Human Events for agreeing to publish our open letter to pro-lifers. This is an open letter decrying the partial birth abortion ruling, and it's going to reach an entirely new audience, and so we're thrilled that that is out today at Human Events, and you will also be able to find the text of this open letter on the internet at coloradorighttolife.org. Yesterday, an editorial ran in the Sunday Denver Post by a contributing reporter, editor for U.S. News and World Report. And this is an editorial that is supportive of Dr. Dobson and Focus on the Family's strategy, their pro-life strategy of using child-killing regulations to try to eventually end legal abortion in America. And, of course, we believe that that strategy is morally wrong and that it is ineffective, in fact, that it has backfired on the pro-life movement. So we are going to quote to you from this editorial by Dan Gilgoff. This is guest commentary from Dan Gilgoff, contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report. And also he's written a book about Dr. Dobson and Focus on the Family and how evangelicals are winning the culture war. So, wow, I watched the news and I'm sort of startled to think that we are winning the culture war. But that is the book written by Dan Gilgoff. And so now to his editorial, his guest editorial in yesterday's Sunday Post. Okay, so Dan argues a couple things here. He says that the Supreme Court opinion upholding the ban on partial birth abortion, that opinion lent further legitimacy to the new notion of fetal rights. And he repeatedly used the word infant and unborn child in place of fetus. So now that's fascinating because in our analysis of the Gonzales v. Carhart decision, that is exactly the opposite conclusion that we have found from excerpts from the ruling. But as I said, this guest editorial in the Denver Post is written by Dan Gilgoff, and Dan is a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report. Dan, thanks for coming on Bob Enyart Live.
Bob, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Dan, I don't know if you saw the blast email sent out by Focus on the Family today. It probably has gone to hundreds of thousands of pro-lifers, and it's regarding the partial birth abortion ruling. And in it, if I could quote one line from this ruling from Dr. James Dobson and ask you if you agree.
Sure.
He writes that ending partial birth abortion does not save a single human life. And that's put out in an email today, and it's also available on their website. So would you concur with that assessment of Dr. Dobson? By the way, we've been collecting quotes like that.
Sure.
The Thomas More Society, their Pro-Life Law Center, Bob Unruh, who writes for WorldNet Daily, Family Research Council, there's beginning to be an admission that those who are objecting to the partial birth abortion strategy, that they are correct in their analysis that this ban and the Supreme Court ruling gives no authority even to prevent a single abortion. So I'm asking, for starters, do you agree with Dr. James Dobson on that quote?
Well, I would tend to agree, I guess, as a technical matter. But I think if you talk to a lot of activists who are in the mainstream of the pro-life movement, and I talked to a handful in doing this piece for the Denver Post yesterday,
sure,
you will find that Well, that technically may be true. That is, this is a procedure, a partial birth abortion, that could be gotten around, could be circumvented by doctors with similar types of late-term abortions. There's this thinking, this kind of incrementalist thinking that I think describes or characterizes the mainstream of the pro-life movement that says this will prevent further abortions because it forces kind of society to consider the possibility that a partial birth abortion is kind of beyond the pale morally, and that it forces a national kind of recognition or discussion of what that procedure entails. And okay. Because of that, that very discussion will deter others, will deter women from having an abortion.
Dan?
And so in that way, the pro-life movement, I think, hopes that it would prevent abortions, although you're right, it's a technical matter.
Okay.
This does not outlaw certain types of abortions.
All right. We're speaking with Dan Gilgoff, author of a guest editorial in Sunday's Denver Post. He's also a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report and author of The Jesus Machine, How James Dobson, Focus on the Family, and Evangelical America Are Winning the Culture War. So, Dan, could you at least then, in consenting, you said technically, if we want to look at it technically, in consenting with all these pro-life leaders who are coming out now after the fact and acknowledging that ending partial birth abortion, to quote Dr. Dobson today, does not save a single human life, do you think it would have been appropriate for our pro-life leaders to tell the rank-and-file Christian and pro-lifers and their donors over the last, it's been about a 15-year fight to get this ban in place. Don't you think the average pro-lifer should have known that from the beginning so that they could decide if they wanted to put their money and time and effort and votes into a massive, expensive campaign that had no authority to save a single life? Wouldn't it have been wise for our pro-life leaders to be upfront with that, rather than telling us that after all the money is spent and the time is gone?
Well, I don't know, though, that there, I guess that suggests there's been a concerted campaign to disguise the fact that as a technical matter, this would not a wholesale ban abortions or do away with a great number of abortions.
Well,
I think that the leadership of the pro-life movement that has been pushing for such legislation is quite sophisticated and knows that, I guess in their own minds, a long-time effort to, say, amend the Constitution with an amendment to totally ban abortion is such a long shot and is so unlikely to succeed that taking baby steps like this, while not outlawing abortion entirely, is kind of, we'll get you there quicker. I guess that's their thinking.
Okay, but so Dan, we've been documenting, for example, recorded phone calls to pro-life organizations around the country, notarized affidavits by donors who were informed and were told explicitly that the partial birth abortion ban would, for example, stop all third trimester abortions. It would outlaw all late-term abortions. That has been the belief, the general mindset of the pro-life rank-and-file donor for many years. And it's only now coming out that, in fact, they did not have the correct understanding that this is merely a regulation. It's a regulatory ruling on partial birth abortion that you could only perform a partial birth abortion to the navel, not to the neck. I don't know if you've read the ruling itself.
I have indeed, yeah.
Yeah, but it basically says legally preferred now. And it lists other ways to kill the same baby. And one is you could do a partial birth abortion to the navel. You could pull the baby out, breech, up to the navel. And then it literally says you could rip its legs off or you could kill it in any number of ways. And so it doesn't even ban partial birth abortion. It's just a variation. At the highest level of law in America, our U.S. Supreme Court has given us a manual on how to legally perform a partial birth abortion to the navel. Don't you think the pro-life movement at large should have been aware all along that that's really what we were going after?
Well, I think that if the pro-life movement and its leadership was misleading its followers and the rank and file into believing that this would be a wholesale ban on third trimester abortions, then that was misleading, and that would be wrong.
I appreciate that, and I understand you said if in fact that had happened, and we've been documenting that that's exactly what has happened. Could I quote from your editorial?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. You say that Anthony Kennedy lent further legitimacy to the notion of fetal rights, the new notion of fetal rights. He repeatedly used the word infant and unborn child in place of fetus. And, Dan, that argument has been making its way through the conservative Christian media, like World Magazine, a few weeks ago.
Sure.
But in actuality, the ruling, and I could quote from it for you. In fact, I've memorized it in these sections. Twice, they discuss the terminology of fetus and child. And both times, the one place they say the fetus that may become a child, which indicates their legal opinion that a fetus is not a child. And in the other place, they say that the reason they shut down, that they overturned the Nebraska partial birth abortion ban, one of the reasons was that it used the word child. And they said Congress responded to our concerns, and the PBA ban uses the word fetus. So the Supreme Court justices did mention this fetus versus child terminology twice. In both times, they said it's a fetus, not a child, and we're upholding this ban because it doesn't call the unborn a child, because it calls it a fetus. So I'd like to suggest that when you and Lynn Vincent at World Magazine, when you guys say that the justices actually were using the word child in place of fetus, as though that's a victory for the pro-lifers, that's really the exact opposite of the case. They argued that it's not a child, it is a fetus, and because this ban uses the term fetus, we approve of this ban. So do you think that's a matter that maybe you could investigate further and find out if, in fact, you've presented it exactly the opposite of the ruling?
Well, you know, in quoting from the ruling here, as I do in the course of this piece in the Denver Post yesterday, Anthony Kennedy says that the state may use its regulatory power to bar certain procedures and substitute others
right.
in order to promote respect for life, including life of the unborn. So I think it's difficult to get more of a clear kind of endowment of certain types of rights or privileges that should be afforded to the unborn.
Okay.
And quoting that exact language that Kennedy employs in the course of the decision.
Okay.
And I also think that represents a major kind of innovation in the history of the pro-life movement, where you could cite otherwise, but in the history of 30-plus years since Roe v. Wade, of a instance in which a type of abortion procedure was actually upheld by the Supreme Court.
Mm.
And that's what makes this, although for the pro-life community, certainly not any kind of unqualified victory, it certainly makes it a historic one nonetheless. And so I think, taking the facts in isolation as you are, you could make a case that the pro-life movement has been overselling the gains of this decision.
Well,
and that very well may be the case. But I think it's important to point out that properly placed in the context of the history of the movement, that this actually does represent a kind of major departure success-wise.
We're speaking with Dan Gilgoff, contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report. Dan, the pro-life movement has repeatedly used this quote out of the ruling that the government could use its regulatory authority to show its profound respect for the life within the mother. And that's basically what you're doing now in this argument. You're lifting those kinds of quotes and saying, look, this is really good that for the pro-life movement that the court is using this terminology. The problem with that is that what I just said, that was lifted from a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1992, 15 years earlier, and that terminology did not lead to personhood or respect for the unborn child, and in fact, about 20 million children have been aborted since that terminology was put in place. And when Anthony Kennedy talks about respect for life, he's talking about respect for a dead body in a cemetery. That's the kind of respect he is willing to grant the government to use in the abortion issue. He points out, he says optimistically, that the medical profession may devise less shocking methods to abort the late-term baby. Well, he uses fetus there. So he is not saying that this is a child, it's not a fetus, it's a child. He's saying that we're concerned about the image of the abortion industry. Perhaps the abortionists can find a less shocking method to abort the late-term baby. They say this is a fetus that may become a child, and we're upholding this law because it uses the word fetus. It doesn't use the word child. So I think on that one issue, and I'm happy to let you have the last word on that, but I think it really misrepresents the case to pull out these short excerpts and use them to suggest this is a victory when the entire ruling advocates the right to kill late-term children, including by partial birth abortion.
Yeah, I disagree with you, and I think there are other instances in the course of the ruling. I'll cite another one where Kennedy says some women come to regret their choice to abort the infant life they once created and sustained.
Yeah.
I think that is a clear enunciation of a life inside the mother that he is purporting to protect in some fashion, even if he doesn't go as far as you would like to have him. Also, in talking about this case in isolation, I think that you face the danger of presenting the context in which the justices were ruling as if it were in a vacuum, when in fact the Supreme Court had just ruled in this case a few years prior in striking down the Nebraska partial birth abortion law.
Right.
And so one of the onuses that was on the Supreme Court was to narrowly define partial birth abortion in the procedure. And what you and other pro-life critics are declaring that this lays out a manual for alternative types of late-term abortions. I mean, medically, that is absurd. Obviously, these doctors are aware of the alternatives available to them.
Actually, BayAreaInside.com, they're reporting on abortionists, the medical community, that is now experimenting with new forms of late-term abortion to comply with the ruling. And the ruling does explicitly advocate that the baby could be delivered partial birth abortion to the navel, which is a 4-inch variation on a standard partial birth abortion, and then killed. And so that is a new partial birth abortion technique that the ruling actually prefers. And, Dan, are you aware that the ruling doesn't actually ban partial birth abortion? For example, the justices concur if the woman is overdilated and the baby comes out to the neck, the abortionist could go ahead and perform a standard partial birth abortion.
Well, one of the problems here is that we're dealing with a kind of clumsy terminology, and the terminology of partial birth abortion that has been adopted that doesn't necessarily conform perfectly to medical techniques. I think that the point that I was trying to make earlier was that one of the reasons why the justices and Kennedy in particular felt compelled to lay out alternative options in late-term abortions was because the previous ban was struck down precisely because it did not do that. It defined partial birth abortion too broadly. And
yeah,
I think
yeah.
the allegation that someone like Kennedy is trying to do PR for the abortion providers is something that I think most mainstream legal analysts, or for that matter, most of the leadership of the pro-life movement would disagree with.
Our open letter to Dr. Dobson quotes explicitly from his ruling, and he is concerned with the public perception of the late-term abortion procedure, so that he advises the medical community to devise less shocking methods to abort the late-term fetus. And he says that the abortionist may not want to tell the patient the details of the procedure because the patient may be disturbed at hearing the details. So he actually advocates that the abortionist hold back the particulars. They describe the grisly method of killing one of these babies, with the baby's legs and arms twitching and all, and being stabbed in the back of the neck. And he says, and the justices concur, that any operation can make a patient queasy. So therefore, it's natural the abortionist may want to hold back the description of the procedure for the sake of the patient not being queasy. So it is a complete misrepresentation to suggest that Anthony Kennedy in any way has advocated the personhood of the child or the right to life to the child. He is advocating the right of the government to regulate a medical procedure like they might do with dialysis. And he is advocating that for the sake of the abortion industry, that the public perception be considered. And that's what this regulation does. And therefore devise less shocking methods to kill the baby. I submit to you, Dan, that it is a complete misrepresentation to say that Anthony Kennedy had the concern of the child in mind in any way, or that this ruling indicates any concern for the unborn.
Yeah, and that's just the point where we're going to have to disagree.
Well, like could you quote an excerpt that shows a concern for the child?
Well, I quote, I think, at least two, if not more, and so I think it's hard to square this perception of Kennedy carrying the water of the abortion providers. I think it's difficult to reconcile that with his language talking about the life of the unborn and the value of affording that life certain protections. So I think that allegation of, like I said, him being a kind of water boy for the pro-choice movement is a little bit difficult to square with that.
Okay, can we address the whole incrementalism issue?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, thanks. In your guest editorial in the Denver Post yesterday, you quote from the open letter to Dr. Dobson, which has been published today in Human Events and the Washington Times and the Colorado Springs Gazette and other papers within the next weeks. You quote the signers that say compromised incrementalism violates God's enduring command, do not murder. And throughout, you call us the Puritans. Is that what you, you call us the purists?
Purist
versus the incrementalist. The sentence right before the one you took out of our letter states that incrementalism is fine. And every one of the signers, including Human Life International, American Life League, Colorado Right to Life, they all advocate incrementalism. What they oppose is compromised incrementalism that violates God's enduring command, do not murder. So that if you can only save one or a thousand, you save one or a thousand. But you do not support child-killing regulations that undermine personhood and that end with, and then you could kill the baby. So it is a misrepresentation to say that this group is against incrementalism because it makes our group seem irresponsible because we can't save all these kids in one fell swoop. And we're not saying that if you can't save them all, let them all die. But that's how we're being presented. And so I'd like you to consider, Dan Gilgoff, in the future, this purist group of pro-lifers that includes some significant pro-life organizations, they are arguing that every time you regulate child killing, you further undermine the personhood of the child in the mind of the public. So if we want to bring about incremental legislation, fine. Just don't support laws that end with, and then you can kill the baby.
Yeah, like I said, I think that is a misrepresentation of what the, the universe of options that were available to the justices there. And I think in taking that out of context, I think it raises this bar of expectations on what the Supreme Court or what the Congress is able to do, and then sets very lofty expectations that are unattainable, which had been the case, I think, the kind of predicament that the pro-life movement found itself in for probably the first 15 or 20 years after the Roe decision was handed down in 1973.
So, Dan Gilgoff, do you think it would have been wrong for the U.S. Supreme Court, with their ruling on April 18th, to have banned abortion, and their reasoning would be that the child is a person and has a God-given right to life? Do you think that would have been wrong for the Supreme Court to do that?
I don't, you know, as a reporter, I don't give my opinions on issues of say, right or wrong.
And right.
As someone who's not enough of a legal analyst to say if that decision was rightly or wrongly decided, I would feel unqualified to comment there.
All right. Remember, the U.S. Supreme Court took the Dred Scott decision and case, and they in fact upheld slavery and returned Dred Scott to slavery. And their reasoning was exactly that they were not judicial activists, and they were upholding the original intent of the Constitution. They quoted Article 1, which counted most blacks as three-fifths of a person. I recently reread Dred Scott. So that when judges do the wrong thing, and then Dr. James Dobson approves of their ruling, saying, well, they did the right thing because they were following precedent. Could you see as a reporter how the Christian right has taken a path that it didn't intend to take at the beginning? Could you
see? Sure, but I guess I'd be interested to hear what you thought the proper course of action that was legally available to the justices
who were
hearing this case.
Sure.
I guess what they would have done that would have been within precedent.
Yeah.
Deciding on the narrow law that was before them.
Yeah, that's a false dichotomy, just like the German judges that upheld laws to kill the Jews and our U.S. Supreme Court that upheld keeping blacks as slaves and owning them as property. A judge is never justified in violating the right to life, liberty, or property. They are never justified. And if their defense is, well, we were following precedent and we were following the law, we convicted those kinds of judges at Nuremberg after World War II. We convicted them of murder because their defense was we were upholding the law, we were following precedent. 50 years ago, America knew enough about morality to say that is not a defense when you rule to kill the innocent. Today, Dr. James Dobson has taken up the legal theory of the defendants at Nuremberg. And as our open letter documents, he has become, and we say this with regret and love for him, he has become a moral relativist. He approves of judges who rule, like Samuel Alito did in 2000, to keep partial birth abortion legal. He approves of those decisions because they're following precedent, even though Dr. Dobson believes that it is murder to kill the unborn child. So, Dan, that's where the Christian right has gone. And we hope that you would reconsider, and whether that's good for the Christian right. We don't think the Christian right is winning the culture war. We think the culture war is sinking us.
Right. Well, I can appreciate that. But if you, you know, the kind of obviously you're taking aim at the title of my book, which is The Jesus Machine, How James Dobson Focused on the Family and Evangelical America Are Winning the Culture War.
Yeah.
But I think if you look at some of the recent legislation, pro-life legislation, including the partial birth abortion ban or the Lacey Peterson law that was turned an assault against a woman on a federal level.
Unborn Victims of Violence Act, that is a great law. Hey, Dan, we are out of time, but I'd like to repeat the title of your book, all right? The book is by Dan Gilgoff. The book is The Jesus Machine, How James Dobson Focus on the Family and Evangelical America Are Winning the Culture War. Dan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Your listeners could find out more about the book by going to thejesusmachine.com. And I appreciate you giving me a chance to state my views.
Sure thing. Thank you. Appreciate that. That is Dan Gilgoff. And we're out of time, but please check out our website, kgov.com. We got a big event this week. And I want to remind you, Maranatha Christian Center, what a great school.